Exhausted with guilt and sorrow, with helpless worry, Zuga left the tent each dawn before sunrise to be the first at Market Square. Perhaps there was a transport rider freshly arrived with medicines in his chests, and certainly there would be Boer farmers with cabbages and onions, and if he was lucky, a few wizened and half-green tomatoes, all of which would be sold half an hour after dawn. On the tenth morning, as Zuga hurried back to the tent, he paused for a moment at the entrance, frowning angrily. The falcon statue had been dragged from the tent, and there was a long furrow, scraped by its base in the loose dust. It stood now at a careless angle, leaning against the trunk of the scraggy camel-thorn tree that gave meagre shade to the camp. The branches of the tree were festooned with black ribbons of dried springbuck meat, with saddlery and trek gear, so that the statue seemed to be part of this litter. There was one of the camp's brown hens perched on the falcon's head, and it had dropped a long, chalky smear of liquid excrement down the stone figure. Still frowning, Zuga ducked into the tent. Jan Sharoot squatted beside Ralph's cot, and the two of them were deeply involved in a game of five stones, using polished pebbles of agate and quartz for the counters. Jordan lay very still and pale, so that Zuga felt a lurch of dismay under his ribs. It was only when he stooped over the cot that he saw the rise and fall of Jordan's chest, and caught the faint whisper of his breathing. "Did you move the stone falcon?" Jan Sharoot grunted without looking up from the shiny stones. "It seemed to trouble Jordi. I woke up crying again and kept calling to it." Zuga would have taken it further, but suddenly it did not seem worth the effort. He was so tired and dispirited. He would bring the statue back into the tent later, he decided. "There are a few sweet potatoes, nothing else," he grunted, as he took up the vigil beside Jordan's cot. Jan Sharoot made a stew of dried beans and mutton, and mashed this with the boiled potatoes. It was an unappetizing mess, but that evening, for the first time, Jordan did not roll his head away from the proffered spoon, and after that his recovery was startlingly swift. He asked only once more after a letter, when he and Zuga were alone in the tent. "Has she gone to heaven, Papa?" "Yes." The certainty in Zuga's tone seemed to reassure him.
"Will she be one of God's angels?"
"Yes, Jordi." "And from now on she will always be there, watching over you." The child thought about that seriously, and then nodded contentedly. And the next day he seemed strong enough for Zuga to leave him in Ralph's charge, while he and Jan Sharoot went up to the koppie and walked out along number 6 roadway to look down on the Devil's Own claims. All the mining equipment, shovels and picks, buckets and ropes, sheave wheels and ladders, had been stolen. At the prices the transport riders were charging, it would cost 100 guineas to replace them. "We will need men," Zuga said.
"What will you do when you have them?"
Jan Sharoot asked.
"Dig the stuff out."
"And then?"
the little Hottentot demanded with a malicious gleam in his dark eyes, his features wrinkled as a sour wind-fallen apple.
"What do you do then?" he insisted.
"I intend to find out," Zuga replied grimly. "We have wasted enough time here already."
"My dear fellow,"
Neville Pickering gave him that charming smile,
"I'm delighted that you asked. Had you not, then I should have offered. It's always a little problematic for a new chum to find his feet."
He coughed deferentially, and went on quickly,
"Not that you were a new chum, by any means."
That was a term usually reserved for the fresh-faced hopefuls newly arrived on the boat from home. Home was England. Even those who were colonial-born referred to it as home.
"I had bet a fiver to a pinch of giraffe dung that you know more about this country than any of us here."
"African-born," Zuga admitted.
"On the Zuga River, up north in Karma's land. Accounts for the odd name, Zuga." "By Jove, didn't realise that, I must say."
"Don't hold it against me," Zuga smiled lightly. But he knew that there were many who would. Home-born was vastly superior to colonial-born. It was for that reason that he had insisted that a letter should make the long sea voyage with him when it seemed that her pregnancies would reach full term. Both Ralph and Jordan had been born in the same house in South London, and both had arrived back at Good Hope before they were weaned. They were home-born. That was his first gift to them. Pickering glossed over the remark tactfully. He did not have to declare his own birth. He was an English gentleman, and nobody would ever mistake that.
There are many parts of your book that fascinated me. I'll teach you what I know about sparklers if you will answer my questions. Bargain?
Over the days that followed, they bombarded each other with questions, Zuga demanding every detail of the process of raising and sorting the yellow gravel from the deepening pit, while Pickering kept turning the conversation back to the land to the north, asking about the tribes and the gold reefs, about the rivers and mountains and the wild animals that swarmed upon the plains in the lonely forests that Zuga had conjured up so vividly in Hunter's Odyssey. Each morning, an hour before the first light, Zuga would meet Pickering at the edge of the roadway above the workings. There would be an enameled kettle bubbling on the brazier, and they drank black coffee that was strong enough to stain the teeth, while around them in the gloom the black mine workers gathered sleepily, still hugging their fur karosses over their shoulders, their voices muted but musical, their movements stiff and slow with sleepiness and the dawn chill. At 100 other points around the growing pit, the gangs assembled, waiting for the light. And when it glimmered on the eastern horizon, the men went swarming down into the workings, like columns of ants along the boardwalks and down the swaying ladders, spreading out on the checkerboard of claims, the hubbub rising, the chant of tridesmen, the squeal of ropes, the hectoring shouts of the white overseers, and then the rattle of bucket loads of yellow gravel into the waiting carts upon the roadway. Pickering was working four claims, which he owned in partnership. "My partner is down in Cape Town. Heaven knows when he'll be back." Neville Pickering shrugged with that deceptively indolent air which he cultivated.
"You'll meet him one of these fine days, and it'll be an experience. Memorable, but not necessarily enjoyable."
It amused Zuga to see how Neville contrived to maintain his foppish elegance of dress, how he could walk the length of the number 6 roadway without the dust hazing the shine of his boots, how he could scramble across the ladder works without dampening his shirt with sweat, or exchange a flurry of blows with a brawny digger who was encroaching on his claims without it seeming to affect the drape of his Norfolk jacket. His casual, sauntering gait carried him from one end of the diggings to the other at a pace which had Zuga stretching his own legs. The four claims were not in a single block, but each separated from the others by a dozen or so intervening claims, and Pickering moved from one to the other, coordinating the work, pulling a gang of half-naked black men from one chain and leading them across to another where the work had fallen behind. Abruptly he was on the roadway, checking the loading of the carts, and then again, just as abruptly, at the fenced-off plot beyond Market Square, where his black workers were rocking the cradles of gravel. The diamond cradles were like giant versions of the old-fashioned baby cradles from which they took their name. Standing on their half-moon-shaped feet, a man on each side keeping them swinging easily from side to side, while a third worker shoveled the yellow gravel into the top deck of the cradle from the mound that the cart had dumped. The top deck was a coarse steel sieve with 1.5-inch openings in the mesh. As the cradle rocked rhythmically, the gravel tumbled and bounced across the sloping sieve, the finer stuff under 1.5 inches in diameter dropping through onto the second deck of the cradle, while the coarse pebbles and waste rolled over under the surveillance of the two cradle men, who watched for the highly unlikely flash of a diamond too big to fall through onto the second deck. A diamond more than 1.5 inches across would be the fortune maker, the finder's passport to great wealth, the almost impossible pony of the digger's dreams, a stone heavier than 100 carats. On the second deck, the mesh was much finer, 1/2-inch square, and a yellow dust blew away like smoke as the cradle agitated it, while on the third deck the mesh was finer still, allowing only the worthless tailings to drop to waste, stuff smaller than the crystals of refined sugar. From the third deck the gravel was gathered with reverential care, and this was washed in a tub of precious water, every drop of which had been transported 30 miles from the Farle River. The gravel was washed in a circular sieve of the number 3 mesh, the finest of all, the worker agitating and dipping over the tub, muddy to the elbows. Finally, the contents of the sieve, cleansed of mud, were dumped onto the flat metal surface of the sorting table, and the sorters began picking over it with the flat wooden blades of their scrapers. Women were far away the best sorters. They had the patience, the manual dexterity, and the fine eye for colour and texture that was needed. The married diggers kept their wives and daughters at the sorting table from the minute the mellow morning light was strong enough until the dusk faded each evening. Pickering was not lucky enough to have women working his tables, but the Africans he had were carefully trained, although never trusted. You would never credit what they do with a good stone to try and get away with it. I smile sometimes at what the Duchess would think if she knew that the shiner hanging around her neck had been up the tail end of a big black basutu, Pickering chuckled. Come, I'll show you what to look for. The wiry little black sorter at the head of the table advertised his superior status by his European finery, embroidered waistcoat and derby hat. But his feet were bare, and he carried his snuff horn in the pierced lobe of his ear. He vacated his seat at the table cheerfully, and Neville Pickering took up the scraper and began to sift through the gravel, a few pebbles at a time. There, he grunted suddenly. Your first wild diamond, old man. Take a good look at it, and hope that it isn't your last. Zuga was surprised. It was not what he had expected. And then his surprise was replaced immediately by disappointment. It was a drab little chip of stone, barely the size of one of the sand fleas which swarmed in the red dust of the camp. It lacked the fire and flash that Zuga had expected, and its colour was a dingy yellow, the colour of champagne, perhaps, but without that wine's sparkle. Are you sure? Zuga asked. Doesn't look like a diamond to me. How can you tell? It's a splint chip, probably a piece of a larger stone. It'll go 10 points. That's a tenth part of a carat, and we'll be lucky to get 5 shillings for it, but it'll pay the wages of one of my men for a week. How do you tell the difference between that and those? Zuga indicated the mound of gravel in the centre of the table, still wet from the washing tub, glistening in 1,000 different shades of red and gold, anthracite black and flesh pinks, the gaudy show of diamondiferous gravel. It's the soapiness, Pickering explained, the soap texture. You will train your eye to it soon. Don't bother about the colour. Look for the soap. He took the stone in the teeth of a pair of wooden tweezers and turned it in the sunlight. A diamond is unwettable. It repels water. So in the wet gravel it stands out, and the difference is that soapy look. Neville proffered the stone. There, I tell you what, you keep it as a gift, your first diamond. They had been hunting for nearly 10 days now, and had gradually moved further and further north. Twice they had sighted quarry, small groups, but each time the quarry had scattered at the first approach. Zuga was getting desperate. His claims were lying abandoned in the new rush workings. The level of the surrounding claims would be sinking swiftly, making his more difficult to work, and every day increasing the danger of rock slide. Those claims had already killed 5 men. Jock Danby had warned him. He was lying now, belly down, on a tiny rocky koppie 50 miles north of the Farle River, 80 miles from New Rush, and he was still not certain when he could finish this business and turn southwards again. Jan Cheroot and the 2 boys were further down the slope with the horses, holding them in a shallow ravine that was choked with scrub thorn. Jordan's girlish tones carried to where Zuga sat, blending with the cries of circling birds, and Zuga lowered the binoculars to rest his eyes and to listen to his son's voice. He had worried about taking the boy on this rough journey, especially so soon after the bout of camp fever, but there had been no alternative, no safe place to leave him. Once again Jordan's stamina had belied his delicate looks. He had ridden hard and kept up well with his brother, at the same time recovering the flesh that the fever had burned from his body. And in the last days, the deathly pallor of his skin had been gilded to velvety peach. Thinking about Jordan led directly to memories of a letter. Memories still so filled with sorrow and raw guilt that he could not bear them, and he lifted the binoculars again and raked the plane, seeking distraction. He found it with relief. There was unusual movement far out on the wide plain. Through the lens, Zuga picked up a herd of 100 wildebeest, the wild cattle of the Boers. These ungainly animals, with their mournful Roman noses and scraggly beards, were the clowns of the veld. They chased each other in aimless circles, nose to earth and heels kicking at the sky. Then abruptly they ceased this lunatic cavorting and stood snorting at one another with wild-eyed expressions of amazement. Beyond them, Zuga caught a flicker of other movement. Until that moment it had been hidden by the dust kicked up by the splayed wildebeest hooves. Carefully he adjusted the beveled focus ring of his binoculars, and the heat mirage trembled and melted before his gaze. Turning the movement into a serpentine wriggle that seemed to float above the plain on a lake of silver, shimmering water. Ostriches, he thought disgustedly. The distant shapes seemed to wriggle like long black tadpoles in the watery, wavering mirage of distance. The long-legged birds seemed to float free of the earth, blooming miraculously in the tortured air above the plain. Zuga tried to count them, but they changed shape and coagulated into a dark, wavering mass, their plumed backs bobbing. Suddenly Zuga sat up. He dropped the binoculars and polished the lens with the tail of the silk bandana around his throat, then quickly lifted them to his eyes again. The grotesque dark shapes had separated. The lumpy, wriggling bodies fined down. The elongated legs had assumed normal proportions. "Men," whispered Zuga, and counted them eagerly. As eagerly as he had ever made a first sighting of the huge ivory-carrying grey bull elephants in the hunting veld. He reached 11 before another layer of heated air intervened and altered the distant man-shapes to grotesque, unsteady monsters once again. Zuga slung the binoculars over his shoulders and went down the slope with the loose scree rolling under his boots. Jan Schroot and the boys lay in the bottom of the ravine on their saddle blankets, their saddles propped behind them as bolsters. Zuga slid down the bank and landed between them before they had returned from the fairyland that Jan Schroot had been spinning for them. "A good bunch," he told Jan Schroot. Zuga reached down and withdrew the short Martini Henry carbine from the leather bucket of Ralph's saddle. He levered the breech block down and checked the weapon was empty. "We aren't after Springbok. Don't you load until either Jan Schroot or I tell you," he ordered sternly. Jordan was still too little to handle the heavy rifle, but he rode well enough to make the encircling sweep with which they could try to close the net. "Remember, Geordie, that you stay close enough to Jan Schroot to hear what he tells you," Zuga told him, glancing up at the sun as he did so. It was well past noon. He would have to move fairly soon, for if they could not surround the little band of black men at the first attempt, if they did not achieve surprise, then it would be the old time-consuming business of sporing them down individually. So far, attempts at doing so had always been interrupted by the sudden African nightfall. "Saddle up," Zuga ordered, and they scrambled to their horses. Zuga swung up onto the bay gelding and glared sternly at Ralph. "Now you do what you're told, or I'll warm your tail feathers for you, young man." He swung the horse's head and pointed it down the ravine, while behind his back Ralph grinned at Jan Schroot conspiratorially. His face flushed with excitement, and the little Hottentot closed one eyelid briefly, but kept his flat, wrinkled Oriental features expressionless. Zuga had chosen the copy with care. From it a ravine meandered out across the plain in an approximate east-to-west direction, and he followed it now, slouching in the saddle to keep his head below the level of the banks, and keeping the gelding down to a walk so as not to raise dust. After half a mile he removed the wide-brimmed hat from his head and raised himself cautiously in the stirrups until his eyes were just above the bank, and he darted a quick glance into the north and then immediately ducked down again.